this meeting for Wednesday, March 22nd, order. It's 9:30 a.m. and we have a quorum. Where's Bill this time?
He's testifying,
and I just found out I'm supposed to be over there Monday, so.
Kind of happy now. I appreciate that on Monday. Yeah.
So, we move down to recognitions and proclamation. Problem Gambling Awareness Month in Lakey County.
And I'll be happy to read the proclamation proclaiming March 2017 as Problem Gambling Awareness Month in Lincoln County. Whereas problem gambling is a public health issue affecting 80,000 Oregonians of all ages, races, and ethnic backgrounds, and has significant personal, social, health, and financial repercussions. And whereas problem gambling has a significant societal and economic cost for individuals, families, businesses, and communities. And whereas problem gambling is treatable and treatment is effective in minimizing harm to both individuals and society as a whole. And whereas Lincoln County has dedicated their efforts to reducing the negative effects of problem gambling for all Lincoln County residents through balanced policies and effective systems of problem gambling services, such as targeted prevention programs and treatment services, and providing education to the public about problem gambling and the availability and effectiveness of treatment. And whereas the National Council on Problem Gambling, the Lincoln County Health and Human Services invite all residents of Lincoln County to participate in Problem Gambling Awareness Month. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners does hereby proclaim the month of March 2017 as Problem Gambling Awareness Month in Lincoln County and encourage all citizens to support the National Council on Problem Gambling and Lincoln County Health and Human Services in their efforts to have a conversation with friends, families, patients, and clients about gambling addiction.
So, who's speaking on this subject? You'll come forward and identify yourself when you get up here. Also, we get a chance to put your name on the roster over there. So we get it right for the minutes, for the written minutes.
Good morning. Thank you for having us. So earlier this year, we were awarded
Introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm Jess Palma, and I'm a health education specialist in public health.
I'm Jennifer Versteeg, and I'm a health education specialist with public health.
And I'm David Kors. I'm the program manager of the co-occurring disorders program for Lincoln County Health and Human Services, including problem gambling.
I'm Azizal Gawa. I'm a problem gambling counselor.
Okay. Please proceed.
So earlier this year, we were awarded a grant for $20,000 regarding expanding the knowledge of problem gambling resources in Lincoln County. And so one of the ways that we've been doing this is through an ad campaign. And so some of the data you did see in the proclamation, 80,000 Oregonians experience problem gambling, which comes out to be about one in every 37 Oregonian adults experiencing problem gambling. The average age of onset is 40 years for females and about 33 and a half years for males. 63.4% of problem gamblers report having gambling debt. So this is, of course, you know, in addition to any other debts that they might have, as you know, as far as maybe student loans or car loans, house, etc. And then that gambling debt alone is on average $23,374. So, you know, we know that this is a big problem, and we know that people are wanting help and that there is hope and people can get better. So our campaign was focusing on advertising what's available. So to achieve optimal advertising, we're running our ads in newspapers, both the print version as well as online. It's in Newport and Lincoln County movie theaters, on local radio stations, and then this is the first time actually we've been able to utilize Facebook and Twitter, so we're using social media sites also to get the word out. And this is an example of our movie theater ads. They run 360 times a week. They have an average 13,000 viewers, and they also rotate on the lobby screens as well as the movie theater screens. So just to make it a little more realistic, and I know I'm really excited about our success with the social media. In January, we had almost 50,000 times that our ads were seen online, but we had actually 842 times that people clicked through on their links. So they went to Oregon Problem Gambling Resource, that website, to talk to a gambling specialist, to find help for a loved one, to, you know, really start that process of healing and to get a referral. And then in February, you know, we had similar numbers. We had a little bit of a hang up with Facebook running some of our ads, but that's all taken care of and they're set to run through the rest of the year. And this is just the very beginning of it. So just so that everyone is aware, these are some of the resources. We have Lincoln County Problem Gambling Treatment Program. They're available 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. And then the Oregon Problem Gambling Resource is available 24/7 on the hotline and on their website as well. And there's additionally a number that people can text, but it's only available during weekdays.
In Lincoln County, we have a unique partnership. We're really fortunate that our prevention team is now housed under our Lincoln County Health and Human Services umbrella. So we have an opportunity to work directly with our treatment providers, and it's been a great complementary partnership. We're able to raise awareness, which in turn helps build their clientele, and their funding is actually based on performance measurements and how many people and referrals that they're getting. And so this is a really great partnership between the four of us, and we're really fortunate that we're housed and set up the way that we are here.
Just to speak a little bit more about prevalence specifically in Lincoln County, there have been prevalence studies that demonstrate that it could be as large as a 10% increase in communities where there are casinos. And so we do have Chinook Winds up in Lincoln City. Within 30 minutes of Lincoln City, as you know, is Spirit Mountain, and about 45 minutes south of Yaha is Seven Feathers. So that it increases the prevalence of problem gambling, most likely in our community. There are over 45 lottery retailers in Lincoln County that do have video poker or video line games available, and that is pretty prevalent. So we're here to help, and there are stickers on those machines that have our problem gambling helpline. So hopefully people are reaching out. Azusa's been here for 2 months, and when she got here, we had 8 clients, and now we have 14. So I think that's attributable to what we're doing with the prevention side, and also Azusa's been doing a lot of outreach to treatment providers in the community, including our own providers and also addiction providers that are here in the community.
So let me ask you a question, if you don't mind. You say you've got 14. How long does the average person stay in your counseling?
So the state pays for up to a year of treatment, and if somebody needs more, then we can write what's called a variance request to have more treatment if they're still working on the issues that they're presenting us with. And I'd say about, I think the numbers are about up to 50% don't hang out too long, because gambling is a very entrenched challenge for people, and there's a lot of there's not as much belief about what there's a lot of stigma around it, so it's difficult for people to be aware that gambling is a problem. So when they come into therapy, they think, oh, I've got this, I don't have a problem now, I can just leave and I'll go ahead and handle this myself. Oftentimes there's a relapse, and we just try to let people know that we're there and available for them.
And that fund all flows from the state, from gambling dollars, if I
That's
remember
correct.
Right?
That's right.
In the legislature.
Right.
So you're basically, all you're doing is, if you're a gambler and you're using your own money, you're not, it's already set aside for this. Am I correct?
That's correct. It's 1% of lottery dollars are allocated for treatment, and we have a grant from the state that's based on what our current caseload is, and that could be increased if we increase our caseload. And we often tell people when they start, you don't have to pay for treatment, it's already prepaid. You already paid for it.
And
unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, at least it's there.
Exactly.
The question is what's your capacity?
It's unfortunate that it's a problem.
How many people could you see if you had were able to get to more people?
So we were able to secure some extra funding to train more clinicians in problem gambling, and so we, from the state, and we're in the process of training all of our co-occurring disorders clinical staff to be gambling literate and able to provide gambling treatment services. So at this point, Azusa would be able to carry about 20 to 30 people. And then when we have those additional folks, we have two people that have just completed training now, so we could increase that up to about 50.
You don't mind if I keep asking a few more questions?
You're doing fine.
Okay, sure. One of the things that disturbs most problem gamblers is privacy. Mm-hmm. How do you go about making sure that their privacy is protected if they enroll in the program?
I don't think we really take any, and you're welcome to say anything additional here, but I don't think we take any steps outside of what we do with all of our clients, which is we're obligated through laws involving HIPAA and 42 CFR, which is confidentiality regulations for addictions, to maintain as much as we possibly can, right? So we can't disclose information to other people unless there's an imminent risk. Unless there's a release of information on file. So I don't think we really take any extra steps for problem gambling than we do with anybody else, but those standards are already pretty high.
Yeah, they're pretty tight, I agree. Yeah. And that's one of the things, though, with a lot of people, why they don't enroll is they're worried about that it might get out in the public that they recognize the problem.
That's correct. So, We have a client here recently that told me that she just writes down on her calendar that she's going to the DMV.
So, okay, that's your department. What is you?
Well, I'm interested in the treatment process. Certainly when you talk about addiction to substances, I guess at least in my mind that's more of a medical environment and there's medical-type treatments, for lack of better words. But you know, how do you deal with really, I guess, what I would call a psychological state? So what are the types of treatment? Are there ones that are more effective?
No. I asked Susan if she wanted to take that. Gambling is a crisis of belief in a different way than addiction, than substance use is, right? So we have to work more with people's beliefs and values than we do with people that are dealing with regular addiction, although that's still very much in the picture. So we use more of CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, for addiction, probably than other addiction treatment. We work a lot on values. We work a lot on the value of money. We work a lot on the finances. A lot of people that are attracted to gambling and end up with a gambling addiction are attracted to it because of their belief in or their need to make more money, status, and that kind of thing. So we try to work with them on their values and how their values fit in with their larger life goals and make any changes that we can with them around how they're approaching that. It's much more of an internal process. It's less behavioral, it's more belief, right? So, and Azusa and I have known each other for a while, and she's really good at going right for those beliefs, better than I am, I think.
So, Azusa, I'm going to ask you this question specifically, because you're the one that deals directly with the client, or you both deal with the clients all the time.
I am handing it off to her.
Yeah.
You have to get closer to the mic so we can hear you.
Okay.
So if a person comes in and they say they have a gambling addiction problem, how do you go about relaxing them, getting them to start to deal into this issue? Because it's something that a lot of people don't want to address.
So when they come in, you know, saying that they have a problem gambling already, you know, they have the consciousness, they have the awareness of, you know, gambling being a problem, right? And then that's kind of easier for us to start the treatment. And the hard thing is, like, problem gambling treatment is open for family members and friends who are affected by gamblers or gamblers gambling, right? So when the family members comes in and saying that my partner has a problem with gambling, that's more tougher, right? And when I'm working with the family members, you know, we talk about how to protect yourself first, you know, protect your family members first before, you know, being able to have space and room for the gamblers to heal,
right? And when gamblers comes in, being resistant for a change, we use a lot of motivational interviewing. And, you know, we talk about, well, there is losses about giving up on gambling, you know, and then we talk about losses and gain of making a change or not making a change, right? So it takes a lot of time for us to get it going, right? But,
am I making sense?
You're doing just fine.
Yeah.
We understand.
But once they make decisions to stop gambling, you know, we'll talk about, well, this is where you want to get to, and this is where you are. And, you know, gamblers are problem solvers. They like the challenges, you know, they are go-getters. And they have big dreams, big visions, you know, where they want to get to. They have the fantasy, right? So we talk about those dreams they wanted to achieve by gambling, and, you know, how can you get there without gambling? Make steps, like concrete steps, and then we try to make that happen outside of the counseling. Am I making sense?
Yeah, thank you.
So it is important for us to meet with the gamblers, like, regularly and consistently. And they're not checking with them, yeah.
Cool. One last question, unless you have anything else.
I've got one. But
okay, go ahead.
Well, I'm just interested in how did you become interested in this line of work, and what training certification did you have to go through?
So you want me to go first?
Sure. Okay. Well, I was not interested in doing the problem gambling counseling, actually. And I was living in Portland, and I'm from Japan. And, you know, in Asian countries, there is so much belief in superstition, you know, lucky colors, not lucky numbers. You know, we are all about luck and fortune. And I did not realize the gambling itself was a cultural, social issue. So when I was growing up, you know, I was gambling with my family, you know, playing like games and stuff like that. And I did not realize gambling problem was such a big deal in my country until I graduated from PSU. And I had to get a job quickly, otherwise I would get kicked out of this country. So I said Asian and counselor in Portland, and there was only one job popped up, and then they were hiring Asian outreach person in Portland community, and I was like, okay, that's interesting. So that's how I ended up doing the problem gambling, but I fell in love with it.
And the training, where...
I can fill you in on
okay.
that. So first, briefly, my story is that I was in undergrad in psychology, and I was working on a crisis line, the suicide crisis line, the suicide prevention lifeline, and I spoke with a woman who was very escalated and very panicky and very suicidal, and I was working with her for about a half hour before she was able to tell me why she felt that way. And why she felt that way was because she had been gambling, and her family did not want to allow her back in her house, in her family's house, and she had no place to go. And I thought to myself, gambling, you don't ingest a substance, what's the problem? Just stop, right? And so from there, I thought, well, this person is obviously in a crisis. We need to explore what this is about. So I found out more and more, and went on to grad school at Lewis and Clark, where they have a gambling program, a gambling addiction program. So the certification process in Oregon, there's a certified gambling addiction counselor certification, and there's two stages to that. The first stage requires 60 clock hours of education and gambling-specific counseling. Usually, I think there is, you have to have at least a bachelor's, if not a master's, in a behavioral health field. For the level one, you could have a bachelor's. For level two, you have to have a master's degree in mental health counseling. And after the initial 60 CEUs, they need to get, I think it's 500 supervised hours. And I'm a credentialed supervisor in problem gambling treatment. There's also a national certification through the National Council on Problem Gambling, and that's a separate certification that is very, there's a lot of reciprocity and overlap in those two certifications. So counselors have to have continued education. Every 2 years, they have to demonstrate ongoing CEUs to keep their certification and pay their necessary fees to ACPO, the Addiction Counsel Certification Board. So that's kind of the process.
So
Thank you.
I will ask you one last question, but we got to move on here. Multiple addictions. Are you finding it common for the gambler also to have other addictions? And any idea what the percentage might be?
I think one out of three gamblers have a problem with alcohol or drug.
Okay. And, or more than that. I think it's 30 to 50%.
Mm-hmm. 30 to 50%.
Yeah. Yep. Well, about 30% with mental health issues.
Mm-hmm. So, well, how much now?
Around 30.
Wow. Mm-hmm. High number. So you're dealing with a lot of other things, too, mm-hmm. that you, it's got to be a challenge when you start dealing with multiples of drug addiction and then throw gambling in. Thank you very much for the work you do.
Thank you.
Letting us understand more about what you do.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And with that, I'll move for approval of the resolution proclaiming March 2017 as Problem Gambling Awareness Month in Lincoln County.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes.
We have some gifts for you.
I'm running a river.
Thank you. Have a conversation.
September's art is up in County.
Oh, good. Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we move down to the consent calendar. Consent calendar items are things of routine nature or you previously heard. You see anything you'd like to change on the consent calendar?
I don't have anything I'd like to change, but I would ask Council Belmont to talk briefly about the targeted case management program where we are in partnership with the school district.
Sure.
Item H1.
Sure. This is actually a program that's been in place for a number of years. It used to be managed through our Children and Families Commission when that was in existence, and now it goes through the county itself, directly through the county, and these are pass-through monies that go to Lincoln County School District, and they're what are called the Juvenile Crime Prevention Program funds, and the school district has four homeless education literacy project advocates that actually provide services to homeless and at-risk youth, and so there's a variety of services that are provided through the funding. Some of the things they do is they do some tutoring, intensive tutoring for at-risk kids. They do a job shadow program, some job opportunity training. There's some substance abuse programs for kids at risk. They actually do, I think they used to call it Scared Straight. They do take kids to the Oregon State Penitentiary, at-risk kids to do that. And then they're also, it's in conjunction with our school-based health center, so there's also services that are provided, health and mental health services as needed for kids to go through it. So it's a long-standing program, and I think it's a very worthwhile program.
I think it's another example of the things that are done to address at-risk students and try to reduce the likelihood that they'll end up in the judicial system, and if so, to keep them out.
That's right.
Rescinding, keep them from rescinding. So, all right. With that, I'll move for approval of the consent calendar.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. We move down to decision in action, initiating amendment to the Lincoln County Comprehensive Plan and Land Use Code, update farm and forest ordinances from Chapter 1 of the Lincoln County Code as part of the Multiple County Code Update Project sponsored by the Oregon Department of Land and Conservation Development. Joshua and Otto, please.
Good morning, Commissioners. So this morning we're asking you to initiate a number of amendments to our Farm and Forest Ordinance, Chapter 1 of Lincoln County Code. Over the years, as legislation comes down and rulemaking happens at state agencies, the rules change, in particular with the farm use zone, our agricultural conservation zone. The rules have changed quite a bit over the years, and we have been out of practice updating our code as the rules and statutes change. So DLCD, Department of Land Conservation and Development, at the state is providing technical support through some grant funding they've diverted over the last couple of bienniums. We're in the 2015-2017 group of seven counties that were chosen based on how out of date their codes were. So we've been working on it for almost a year and a half. It's been a lot of work with the assistance of Angela Planning Group, a consultant that was brought on to assist us. What eventually happened is they provided us an audit of our farm zone, highlighting the areas that were out of date and what needed to be amended and brought in from the rules and statutes. And so we've created a legislative draft highlighting those changes, and we're ready to bring it to our Planning Commission for a public hearing. We've got that scheduled for April 10th. We just need your blessing to move forward with that through a resolution. It's just pretty much as simple as that. When we come back to you for the official adoption, we can get a little more into the weeds, but today we're just asking you to initiate the process.
Pretty straightforward. I don't have any questions.
I don't have any questions. I just glanced at the resolution, and it's, like you say, it isn't specific at this point. It's just the basic.
Correct.
Let's do it.
It's initiating the process.
Right. Like last week when we asked you to initiate the code amendment to move the Bayshore line, your question was well put to me last week, was you're only voting to start the process rolling, that we would circle back. Although in this case, and Josh has done a good job of explaining this, a lot of this is just housekeeping stuff. There aren't an awful lot of like policy calls here. This is an overdue realignment of our code to make sure that we're current with changes in statutes and OARs. And so we were glad to be part of that.
Yeah, our obligation when the rules or statutes change is either to fold them into our code or to direct apply them. So these are rules and that we're already applying. It just, when you've got staff turnover, for instance, there's a danger that some of these things aren't being applied correctly, not having them actually in our code. So,
I'll take a motion. We'll move for approval of the resolution initiating amendments to Lincoln County Comprehensive Plan and Land Use Code to update farm and forest ordinances. Chapter 1 of Lincoln County Code as part of a multi-county code update project sponsored by the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development.
Second.
You're going to call for a vote?
Sorry.
I'm going to drink some water so I can continue to talk.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes.
What a mouthful.
Yeah, I was listening to you talk. I read that too. I was like, make it a little quicker to start. Listen, this project started.
The resolution that you're signing has actually got a shorter title. I did shorten it up. So
the title is longer than the code amendments.
Yeah. So I kind of
clarified. Not shorter.
Mr. Chairman, I thank you, and I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge the good work of my colleague Joshua. This has been a rather tedious, painstaking process to go through this stuff, and he deserves a tremendous amount of credit for sticking with this and taking on this project. And so again, I just want to recognize his contributions to this ongoing effort. Thank you.
Okay.
Good work, Joshua.
We'll jump down to reports, and looks like Mr. Green would like to talk to us about the Newport Terminal.
Good morning, everyone. How are you?
Good to see you, Kevin.
Yes, my name is Kevin Greenwood. I'm the general manager at the Port of Newport.
And Walter Chuck, the current president.
And we are here to talk a little bit about the Port of Newport's International Terminal Shipping Facility project. Really, the number one goal of the Port Commission since I've been with the port since February 2014 was really to make the international terminal generate enough cash flow to cover expenses. Has been really the number one priority for me and the commission, and I think that we are getting very close to completing the financing for this project. So I'm going to give a little bit of history. You know, this entire international terminal project really began back in 1998, I believe, when my predecessor, Don Mann, had been on the job for 2 months or so, and he gets a phone call from the terminal manager saying, "Hey, boss, we've got bunker crude oil bubbling out from underneath the terminal." And so fast forward to 2006, and the port put Measure 21-114 on the ballot that November. And that was a $15 million general obligation bond. And the purpose of that bond was to provide funds for capital construction and improvements necessary to rebuild the ship cargo dock and rebuilding the cargo, barge, and work docks to accommodate the fishing fleet, deep draft vessels, and barges. And the current Port Commission is following through on the actions of that past Port Commission over a decade ago. And so I think that's really important because really when you look at the environmental issue that was there, you know, that has been accomplished. That's been cleaned up. Clearly the distant water fleet and the fishing opportunities, that's certainly been provided. The one thing that we have not done yet is get the cargo and the deep water shipping back. And so that's really the push moving forward. So we have a world-class terminal facility, and the public and the voters have seen really a wonderful terminal built through a mixture of bonds, loans, and grants totaling $27 million, including almost $1 million in mitigation costs. So this has been a very large project for the port. Since it opened in 2013, the terminal has certainly provided ample space for the fishing fleet, and we certainly appreciate and understand the huge economic contribution of the fleet to Lincoln County and Oregon. That being said, it has been underperforming as far as a business entity for the port. And so the real push has been trying to get this business unit to turn around its financial situation. What I have on the screen here is a summary last year of our general fund or operating funds. And the I want to bring your attention to that third column with the header NIT. That stands for Newport International Terminal. And you can see that we received income of about $383,000 and that we've got expenses of $603,000. And so that net to the port, we actually lost $220,000 on the operations of the NIT. Now, if you look right next to it, the South Beach, luckily we've had a really good run with our recreational marina and our RV park. And you can see that the net there is, you know, over $650,000. So in theory, what's happening is South Beach is subsidizing the business activity at the international terminal. So what we're really trying to do is bring this up. It should be noted that the $600,000 in expenses for the international terminal are significantly due to debt service. So of that $603,000, $440,000 is debt service payments. So as far as personnel goes, we're only budgeting and spending about $60,000 a year on personnel out there. So this is not a case of there being bloated personnel costs. This is all debt service. And that right now we have about $5.6 million in standing loan payments separate from the GO bonds that we are obligated to pay every year. So I think that what this slide shows is the port's business situation separate from the great benefits that the community receives from the fishing community. So what we have right now is... Yeah, go ahead. Feel free to jump in. Absolutely.
On that slide,
yes.
I understand the three categories. NO Commission, COMM...
Oh, that's a North Commercial.
Which would be...
So those would be our Port Dock 3, Port Dock 5, Port Dock 7, our Public Hoist Dock. That's the basically the North Commercial fishing docks. That's separate from the international terminal. Admin is basically all of the administrative costs. And then
is Port Dock 1 in there too?
It is. Yep. That's a good reminder.
So it's basically the activities along the bayfront on the north side?
That's correct.
Okay. On the north side of the bay.
Exactly.
All right.
And then we've got the separate line for NOAA as well.
Right.
Okay, so the current condition is pretty much underutilized land. So we have identified that in order to make the terminal a real viable business unit, we really need to generate some cash flow. And by doing that, in order to do that, we're going to need to develop the port's 9-acre site at McLean Point. It's an industrially zoned area. It's about 1,700 feet from the terminal and adjoins, perhaps most importantly, another 30 acres of privately owned land. Currently, all this property is off the tax rolls. Once this project is completed, 100% of the new assessed value will be going into the Newport Urban Renewal District to provide additional utilities to McLean Point. So the site is clean, but we do need to remove 40,000 yards of organic and or unbillable material. We have a relationship with the city of Newport to take that material out to the airport and grade that. And so that's a good good relationship there. And currently there's no public sewer or storm drainage at the site. So our proposed condition is the, I guess what you could say, the lower right-hand corner where that you can see a lot of item logs and containers and that sort of thing. This is not intended to be a real-life expectation of what's going to be going there, but more of a graphic entity of what could happen there. And so what we are looking to do is to build a $6.5 million shipping facility, which is primarily based upon 18 inches of base rock and then about 6 to 8 inches of asphalt, a very large parking lot, if you will, with the highest standard stormwater collection system. There's going to be quite a bit of grading, material removal, and developing wetland mitigation sites as part of the project. So maybe the most important part of this for the community, just outside of the port's bottom line, is the potential for the Hall family to develop that industrial park on the balance of their 30 acres, because I think that that's going to provide a lot of needed warehousing and additional laydown area. Right now, Newport does not have a lot of warehousing and industrial laydown area. And so the proposal that you see there, those graphics to the left, weren't developed by the port. Those are actually from Rondas Corp. So they've already started their preliminary engineering for the industrial park. They're actually in the process of getting the fill removal permit for what they need to do in getting their industrial park built. That's going to be entirely separate from our shipping facility. So this is where we want to go. And, of course, it all comes down to funding and budget. And we received a pretty rare grant back in 2015. We did receive a $2 million Tiger grant, and that required us to have the entire financing in place before that would be released. Last year, we also received a $2 million loan from IFA, which is the State of Oregon's financing arm. And so we have really been hitting the pavement looking for the last $2.5 million. And so we have we went through Connect Oregon unsuccessfully. We went through EDA unsuccessfully. And so we were really kind of like, geez, we're getting near the end of possibilities. But really, we got a great, I don't know if you call it a stroke of luck or just it was very fortuitous. Teven Brothers, who is our the tenant that we have identified to run the terminal and the 9-acre site, brought to us a broker out of Bellevue, Washington, by the name of Sylvan Forestry, LLC. And they are operating out of Coos Bay, and they have three or four other operations in the Pacific Northwest. And they were very interested in getting access to the market within 30 to 40 miles of Newport. And so we have, with Commissioner Chuck and Commissioner Brown as liaisons to me, we have just finished up about a two-month negotiation with Sylvan, and we have they have agreed to put up $2.5 million in private funding to complete this project. So that's huge. And that, I was in Washington, D.C. last week and literally on the phone trying to get these last second items kind of figured out. We had a, the commission had a special meeting on Friday, last Friday at noon, and that was when the memo of understanding was approved by the Port Commission. All of those documents are on our website if people are interested about those details. But at that point, the MOU has been forwarded to our attorney to develop a more legal document. The MOU basically expressed the business components of the agreement between Sylvan and the Port. And that's now a public document. So that is a great that means we've got a project now. And so one of the questions that
Sorry,
has
if I may
yeah
interrupt
yeah feel free
one more
yeah
time.
Absolutely.
Just to clarify, the Tiger funds are actually a grant, correct?
That's correct.
And the state has its money, as it shows on the slide, is a loan. And the private Sylvan Forestry money, is that a loan also?
I think that it is a loan, and it's a creative payback structure. So, and I kind of wanted to touch base on that a little bit.
That's all I need to know.
Yeah, and so what we're going to, so this screen right here is really showing the annual operating projections moving forward, and I know it's a little hard to read that matrix. In the first year, we're anticipating six shipments. Sylvan has, they expect two shipments in the first 6 months and three to five shipments in the second 6 months. So we are looking at about $105,000 gross in tariffs per shipment. So those are fees to the port. And so we anticipate there being almost $650,000 in gross tariff proceeds to the port. So as part of the agreement, the Sylvan and the port agreed that before we do any quote-unquote cost sharing on how those tariffs are going to be utilized, the number one thing that's going to get paid first is our new debt service payment to IFA. So that's $117,000 a year. So before the port spends any of that money, we agreed that we're going to make that loan payment, which is a no-brainer. The second item that we agreed to was the hiring of a second full-time employee down at the international terminal. And that's critical for a number of reasons. One of the things that we have struggled with is we have a single employee down there. When he's sick or on vacation, it's really difficult to provide another equipment operator down there for the fleet. So by having that second employee down there, that's just going to provide a lot more capacity, not only for the shippers, but also for the commercial fishing fleet. So I think that's going to be a beneficial benefit for the fleet. So those two items are going to get covered before anything else. And so after that, you're looking at net tariff proceeds of about $442,000. What we're going to do is we're going to split that money. And what that means is 50% of the net tariff proceeds, we will not charge Sylvan. So what that means is that'll come off of their $2.5 million loan. So we should be generating, you know, that half, that $221,000. We're not going to charge them that. And so by not charging them that, then the $2.5 million will go down. So it's kind of an abatement, if you will. So it's a different way of getting them paid back. And so if we look at $100,000 in gross tariffs, with $50,000 being the net, you're looking at 50 shipments. So 50 shipments would basically get us, we will have settled our agreement with Sylvan.
So let me ask you a couple of questions.
Absolutely.
So if I understand this right, you get $105,000 projected income off the ships.
Yeah, that's a conservative. Mm-hmm.
You predict 6 in the first year?
It'd be 2 in the first 6 months and 3 to 5 in the next 6 months.
So, yeah, we're talking 6 ships.
5 to 7, yeah. But we'd be 6, 7.
Do you project out farther than that in shipments? Because one of my questions relates to the amount of ships of the size to come here. Mm-hmm. A lot of the ships today that are shipping logs are larger than can fit underneath the bridge, if I understand correctly.
We're going to be using handy-sized vessels, or I shouldn't say we. The shippers and Sylvan will be looking at vessels that are about 537 feet long. We'll be able to meet the air draft requirements, which I believe are about 130 feet. We've got depth at the terminal of 35 feet in depth, which was a requirement going back with Teevan and Hancock. That's and TPT. That's where those numbers all came from. We're anticipating each load having about 5 million board feet, and so the depth of 35 feet was actually determined with a 5.5 million board foot load. And we've worked with the Coos Bay Pilots Association to kind of verify what they think. You know, we wanted to make sure that the people that are going to be bringing those vessels in here felt comfortable with all the various drafts.
Well, let me ask you this question then. So, do we know how many ships there are currently in that size class that are entering these ports? Because if we come online and we take this many ships, there's going to be a competition between us and other people that are shipping logs. Will that change? Because we're not getting new ships. We're all fighting for the same group of ships.
Absolutely. And I think that what we're learning is that we have a very nice market here. In the case of Coos Bay, where Sylvan works currently, they have to go out 100 miles to get those logs and bring them to the port of Coos Bay for shipment. Here, you're looking at about 55 million board feet, which is about 10 shipments a year. That's sustainable. You know, that's not taking every last log. That there's about I believe 500 up to 750 million board feet just in the Lincoln County, Benton County area. So there's a real transportation savings by only having to go 30, 40 miles versus 100 miles to bring that product to port. And so I almost kind of think of it like a watershed. There's a transportation shed. And those products will go to the closest port. And so we have that advantage. The International Terminal is a world-class facility. It's actually built with the fender system that's there for handy-sized vessels. So this was built to accommodate these vessels that are in that sub-600-foot range.
Okay. Now, another question. The conflict between other domestic mill users, I won't name the names, but we know they're out there. None of them are within the 40-mile range. All of them are in closer to the 80 to 100-mile range up here. How is that going to affect them? I know we've heard commissioners, we've heard from at least one or two. So how do you address that issue?
Well, primarily the logs that are be going out are going to be hemlock and spruce, which don't have much millable value here in Oregon anyway. The one company that has come to a lot of our meetings, Hampton, they have their mill in Willamette, and they said that they get less than 5%, 5 to 7% of their logs from Lincoln County. So we won't be taking logs from them. The Doug fir will stay here. The shippers haven't said they have planned to do any Doug fir shipping, and the market for it over there isn't as great as it is here. So the high dollar timber, the Doug fir, will be staying here in Oregon.
And what about the Corvallis area?
Corvallis?
Yeah, we haven't heard as much from them, but there's definitely mills there that could be affected.
They have not come to us and had any issues with their supply drying up.
Okay.
So we have quite a few letters of support from Starker Industries and a lot of the small woodland owners here in Lincoln County also.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's so while we're on that topic, doesn't this facility provide the opportunity to export more than just logs?
Yes. Actually, when we were up talking with Teven, they had already been talking with GP. They barge finished lumber down to Southern California, and they've been talking about bringing cardboard back in that empty barge and offloading it here. And they've already been in talks with them, so that's another big possibility. Big saving for GP.
Didn't I also hear Director Greenwood talk about dehydrated pulp?
At this point, a lot of the contracts and the relationships in this industry are intertwined, shall we say, and so there are some opportunities out there, but there haven't been any agreements. So it's a small fraternity of Forest Service businesses, and so one opportunity out of the Halsey area is for wood pulp to be dried basically into bricks or sheets that would then be containerized and then shipped out of Newport to Asian markets to be liquidated or reconstituted. Rewatered, if you will. Those are some opportunities, but this has been a real struggle, Commissioner. I mean, this has not been without opponents. This has not been without misinformation. And so a lot of people are very wary about being too upfront about what their bottom line advantages for shipping out of Newport is. And so we have to be careful moving forward. But I think that once that the port and our partners, that being Teven and Sylvan, can show, hey, you know, that we know what we're doing and we can run this operation professionally and efficiently, we're going to start getting a lot of other customers. I think of Teven and the log exporting kind of like the Macy's at the mall. They're kind of the anchor tenant. But you're going to have other stores in the mall that are going to be coming in and putting down stakes and taking advantage of really this wonderful facility.
Well, the reason I mentioned the pulp is I think that's an example of the wide variety of products that could be exported.
Absolutely.
Plus, with changing technology, who knows what other opportunities may be out there. So I think it's a great project. But go ahead.
So let me ask you a question on the fishing industry side.
Yeah.
As it is now, all the catcher processors that are fishing whiting offshore go to Seattle to unload,
mm-hmm.
or Vancouver. I think some of them go up there to go, depending on the situation. So is there any opportunity for us to become a refrigerated cargo unloading facility and shipping facility from here? Because the more time those boats can stay at sea, the more our fleet that fishes for them can take advantage of production time, which is limited.
Absolutely. As I understand from my research and staff's research, is those vessels are about 300 feet long,
right,
give or take. And so clearly the draft issues won't be an issue. So absolutely. In fact, we have in our tariff, we've identified that potential market, and so absolutely, we're prepared to accommodate those vessels and that product. The one barrier to entry to this whole shipping business is really the heavy equipment, the Laternos, the 988s, and Teven's going to be bringing that equipment to the ball game. And so once that equipment is here, it can be used for a lot of different products. And so once they're here, that's where the opportunities really open up.
So what's the price tag of one of those today? Do you know? You must have looked at
about $800,000 to $1 million.
they're a lot.
We've been in negotiations with Teven for 5 years, and they've actually pre-purchased a lot of their equipment, so they've been sitting on a $6 million investment for the last 4 or 5 years. So,
you know, and I think one of the things too, and the slide that I have up there is the Port Commission just last month formed a terminal users group. And so, Commissioner Thompson, as you know, we've talked about this offline several times, that we have, I think of the terminal as a big sandbox. And we've got a very important distant water fleet and midwater trawler co-op that uses the terminal. And so our biggest concern is making sure that the relationships and the communications between the distant water fleet and the shipping interests are very, very tight. And so I think with the commission adopting this resolution, it's really there for one reason. That's to create an ad hoc committee to review the development of an operations plan that port staff is developing. And that's going to be looking at the transportation plan, the use of space, security, storage, scheduling is a big one. How is the terminal going to be managed when you've got a 600-foot handy-sized vessel and you're trying to get a distant water vessels ready to go to Alaska? That's what this users group is going to be discussing. Is there going to be some arm wrestling? Absolutely. I'd love to sell tickets to these committee meetings because I think they're going to be really, really exciting. And I think that once we go through this process, we're going to have a better product. We're going to be able to prove that we can handle both the distant water fleet and shipping like we have in the historically. And we've done this in the past going back decades. And so I think that that's really the commission's number one priority, is that staff has been working with both of those user groups to make sure everybody's on the same page. And I think when you look at the membership of the people that are going to be on that ad hoc group, it's going to be pretty wide. You've got two fishing fleet representatives. You've got representatives from Teven Brothers, the longshoremen, the stevedore. We've got two leaseholders. Trident Meal Plant is going to be involved. We've got industry support service, and then we're going to get a member from the public. And they're going to be hearing the operations plan presented by the port staff, and then they'll react to that, and where we can make some improvements and make it a stronger plan, ultimately to be adopted by the commission, that's our deliverable. So we are really committed to living up to the values and the goals in that original 2006 ballot measure. This is really the full circle of what this public, what the community wanted when they passed that GO bond 11 years ago.
Other members on that committee are also going to be the Coast Guard and Customs.
It sounds easy. I agree with you. It's going to be a real knockdown drag out unless somebody comes up.
It's been a long journey.
Looking at your map, I've said for years that if the private property owner there, if you look to the just above the thank you, is a piece of land that could have a very narrow dock put in there that could give you an alternate place to move vessels so they could still function. But that would require some piling, driving, and a bunch more money, which is nothing new for the port.
Yeah, right.
Future opportunities.
Yeah, I think the Halls at one time had a fish processing facility there with the dock. I think the regulatory issues, you know, anything's possible, but the regulatory issues would be a big hurdle for them.
But it could be a good site for cold storage.
Absolutely.
Lots of opportunity.
So, anything else?
Good report. No.
Any more questions?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. We'll keep you posted. Thank you.
Thanks for coming and letting us know what's going on. I'm not sure the public realizes what the potential is there. So, thank you. Now, back to the agenda. We move down to commissioner's reports.
I'll just quickly note that you have graciously agreed to appear before the Senate committee looking at the maritime industry sector bill that will be an important step in the development of the maritime industry programs along the coast involving some education classes and job training and creating skilled workers with opportunities for good paying jobs. So thank you for choosing us to do that for me on Monday when I'll be out of the state.
I'm glad to do it. You did the heavy lifting on this for years. I've been talking about the issue and you've made more progress in the last 3 months.
It's been a joint effort.
It's. I'm glad to go over and testify.
Oh, thank you.
I'll pass on this meeting and I have constituent input now. Is there anybody who'd like to address the commission 5 minutes on any subject? So I see two people. Ladies first.
This won't take 5 minutes.
Please identify yourself.
My name is Maria Soss.
And I think you signed up already over there, right?
Yes.
You signed up on the...
Yeah,
okay.
I did.
Thank you.
I appreciate the fact that Commissioners Thompson and Hunt brought up the aspect of other things to be done with the port besides exporting logs. I think there is a export of logs makes the least economic use of timber, and it does not create any more jobs for Lincoln County, which are direly needed. And there is a real need to bring back lumber mills into the county, which could process that timber that's gotten from the county and make more finished products, which could be exported. And that would create a lot more jobs for the county. This goes together with also helping people who are trying sustainable ways of logging, which by selective logging, by not using pesticides, it would create opportunities for them to use the lumber that they do cut and use it nearby and hire people to do it. So I think it's necessary to balance the need for exports and the needs for the county to develop more jobs and to develop a more sustainable way of using the timber that is in the county. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Unfortunately, I did not get here in time to get copies of this name, but it's from your strategic plan that, I'm sorry, Jeff Doyle, Toledo Rural Fire Protection District. The Cascadia Rising Final Action Report, and guess who falls into a bunch of categories to help you guys out? Surprise, surprise, right? I'm not going to go over every single thing. I think you guys will do that ad nauseum probably and try to figure out what you can do to help the county. The two biggest things that we saw on there were the very first strategic recommendation was to build and maintain sustainable readiness capabilities. Well, we're here to help you guys on that one. the communications part. If we do get some kind of tsunami talk in this kind of catastrophe, your EOC is going to probably be underwater. And so what we projected before with our station out there being able to possibly coordinate efforts to the coast, then that's something I think we should all continue to look at. Other short things, we support the idea of bringing more jobs to Lincoln County. But we're the people that actually help the people to get in trouble that have the jobs in Lincoln County already, and any new people will gladly help them too. We had two extrications in the last week. We had one out on at Elmaker, out of our district, that we went and got a gentleman who drove straight into the guardrail at a high rate of speed and split his car in half. That was an hour extrication. Another one yesterday morning, right here on Highway 20. Now, the reason I bring that up is I think that the thing that people lose sight of, North Lincoln is going for a bond to hire firefighters. We have 40 volunteers. We have four paid. And so we already have our people in place. But we have to have the same training, the same equipment, the same expectations as Portland Fire, Corvallis Fire, any of the big boys. We have to have the same equipment for extrication and those kind of things. And the unfortunate thing for Toledo Rural Fire is we're the go-between. We're the highway and the district that goes from somewhere to somewhere, and we don't have much of a pool to draw from other than the tax base. So I don't have anything to do on Wednesday morning, so get used to seeing me.
That's a first. Always good to see you, Jeff.
Well, you know, I appreciate your time, and I know everybody's working on things, but I think the more we, I hate to use this, but the more we stoke the fire, the more people realize that it's not just, we're low on the totem pole. We're not creating jobs. We're not. But what we are doing is we are saving lives and saving people's property. And as we talked about before, that brand new highway, folks, is not in our district, but we still go. And I asked for a report that I'm waiting on from the Sheriff's Department and from OSP of what kind of tickets are you writing on the new highway. The very first one was 90 plus miles an hour. So we haven't even gone through a summer on the new highway with all our wonderful visitors that come and visit our coast. So
my understanding is there have been at least two over 90 miles.
There's much more than that, yes. Well, so thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your good work out there.
Yeah, you're a critical part of the connection to all our fire areas. And we'd love to support you how we can. Anything else, Wayne, that we need to refer to before we... Okay. Our next meeting is right here, 9:30 in the Board of Commissioners room on March 29th.
With that, March, what did you say?
29th, next Wednesday.
Week from today.
Okay, with that, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you.